May it please the court. My name is Rachel Funes, attorney regulation number 41716, and I represent Mr. Downe. Mr. Downe's family is also here in the courtroom today. I'd like to focus my argument today on the fourth issue in the opening brief. And if you have any questions about the other issues, I'd be happy to address those as well. I'd like to try to reserve at least 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Due process requires correct instructions on all the elements, including any affirmative defense that is raised by the evidence. Once the issue of an affirmative defense has been raised, the defendant's guilt must be established beyond a reasonable doubt as to that issue, as well as all the other elements of the defense. The quantum of evidence needed to raise this issue is low. It's been described as a scintilla, some credible evidence, or any evidence. This evidence can come from either the defendant or the state, and it must be viewed in the light most favorable to the defense. Here, the state's evidence raised the issue of self-defense. Viewed in the light most favorable to the defense, the alleged victim here was drinking, was in a gang, and was hanging out with other gang members. He started an intense argument with a rival gang member, threatened to come out and fight him, pointed outside the fence, meaning I'm going to come out there, returned after being pulled away by someone, and punched the shooter in the face after seeing him pull a gun, then turned toward the exit he would have to leave to come out and fight the shooter. This evidence was sufficient to raise the issue of self-defense and require instruction on that issue. The state argues that the court was not required to instruct on this issue because it was inconsistent with Mr. Downe's primary defense, which was that he was not the shooter. But due process entitles Mr. Downe to hold the state to its burden with respect to all of the elements, including the affirmative defenses raised by the evidence. It is not inconsistent to say, I'm not the shooter, and to also say the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the shooter wasn't acting in self-defense. This is the same issue that was addressed in People v. Brown, a recent Colorado Supreme Court case, where the defendant testified that he was not at the scene of the crime and did not shoot the victim. Testified that he was in a hotel room farther away, close to the scene of the crime, and that he had passed out drunk. The Colorado Supreme Court held that this defendant was entitled to a lesser included defense instruction on attempted second degree murder, and that he was also entitled to a voluntary intoxication instruction, which was inconsistent with his theory that he was innocent and was not at the scene of the crime. In making this holding, the Colorado Supreme Court relied on the general principle that a defendant can request an instruction on any defense that is raised by the evidence. And in doing so, it cited Matthews v. United States with approval. That's a United States Supreme Court case that held that a defendant was entitled to an inconsistent entrapment defense where he testified that he did not commit all of the elements of the offense. And entrapment is an affirmative defense. So this principle that was cited in Brown is equally applicable, and certainly Matthews is applicable to this situation, which involves an affirmative defense. Brown also relied on the statute governing lesser included offense instructions. That statute states that a court shall not be obliged to instruct on a lesser included offense unless there's a rational basis in the evidence. And the Brown court held that this statute is unambiguous and is inconsistent with an automatic bar to a lesser included offense instruction because of it being inconsistent with the primary defense.
Want to interrupt. If we assume hypothetically that you can get an inconsistent defense with your theory of defense, mm-hmm. will you just review again for me what you think the scintilla of evidence is? The victim was a gang member, mm-hmm. is one piece. There were some words exchanged, that's the mm-hmm. second piece. And then, I'm sorry, was there any other potential evidence?
Yeah, so there was an intense argument. The victim testified that he threatened to come out and fight the shooter. He said he pointed over the fence, which meant, I'm going to come out there. He pulled up his pants, which meant, I'm not afraid of you. He, in the middle of the argument, someone tried to pull him away, and he went back and re-engaged in the argument. And he also had made a gang handshake with someone during the argument. There were gang-related comments being passed back and forth. And then finally, he punched the shooter in the face. And according to his statement to the police, he did that after seeing the shooter pull out a gun, which I think would indicate that, you know, I'm not afraid of you, even though you have a gun, I'm still gonna try to beat you up. To me, that indicates that he's willing and ready to fight despite the fact that the shooter has a gun. And that just showing a gun isn't gonna be enough.
So is the gun enough? From a defendant's standpoint, in terms of justification, was that an appropriate circumstance from a self-defense standpoint to pull a gun when you've been hit with a fist?
I think viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, I think that was enough of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury, especially when you take into account that there could have been potentially multiple assailants, but the shooter knew there were other members of this person's gang there in that smoking area, and he had threatened to come out and beat him up. And there are other cases where beating somebody up has been held to be enough to raise the issue of self-defense and require an instruction on that issue. And really, whether it's reasonable, whether it's an out-of-proportion response is an issue for the jury to decide.
In any of those other cases, was there a fence between the two people that couldn't be very easily gotten over it between the two people that were in the altercation?
I'm not aware of any specific fact scenarios exactly like that. But in this situation, the fence was, I think, about chest high. And then there was a door that led back into the club and another door immediately next to that that led out to the area where the shooter was. So it would have only taken seconds, probably less than a minute, for the victim to get out there where the shooter was.
Couldn't the, well, under the circumstances, if it would take a minute to get over there, was there any reason why, was it reasonable under those circumstances to shoot a person in the back who had no sign of or indication of having any kind of a deadly weapon?
I think that, again, I think that's an issue for the jury to decide whether that was reasonable. I think that it's enough evidence to raise the issue and instruct the jury on it, and then the state can make that argument and can say that, you know, they proved beyond a reasonable doubt that there wasn't, you know, a reasonable fear here because of the fact that there was a fence or he had to go around. I think this is actually kind of similar to People v. Larson, which I cited, I believe, in the opening brief. In that case, the defendant was entitled to an instruction on defense of others, where he came upon his friends being beat up by the victims. He got out of his car, and the victims stopped beating up his friends and ran away. They were running down an alley, and he shot them in the back. And the court held he was entitled to an instruction in that case. So I think it's arguably similar to that. So back to what I was saying about the statute. In this case, the statute says that if the issue is raised, the guilt of the defendant must be established beyond a reasonable doubt as to that issue. I think arguably that's even stronger than the language in the statute governing instructions on lesser included offenses. And as in Brown, here that statute precludes an automatic bar to instructing on self-defense when it has been raised by the evidence. And I wanted to mention People v. Naranjo, which is a recent case. I filed a supplemental authority on that. And it discusses Brown and talks about how Brown is not limited to the situation of lesser included offenses. It also involves the partial defense of voluntary intoxication. And in Brown, it's also extended to lesser non-included offenses. I think what I'm going to do at this point is reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gabriel Olivares, attorney registration number 45336. I represent the people in this matter. Regarding the fourth issue, the defendant relies primarily on Brown in these cases that involve lesser offenses, whether they're included offenses or non-included offenses. But there's an important distinction between affirmative defenses and lesser offenses, and that distinction is highlighted first in Hendrickson and then later in this court's opinion in Brown, which was later affirmed by the Supreme Court. In Hendrickson, the division of this court pointed out that the entrapment, which is an affirmative defense, presupposes the commission of a crime. Therefore, the defendant must admit that he engaged in the prescribed conduct. Brown pointed out that the lesser included statute does not create such a requirement. Therefore, the defendant is not required to admit anything, nor is he required to admit that he engaged in the act. Self-defense, if you look at the statute, presupposes that the defendant used physical force on another person. Therefore, the defendant must admit that he used physical force. Matthews points out, and Brown and Taylor go to great lengths to say that Matthews isn't binding because it relies on federal statutory law, and that's the federal statute for entrapment. But Matthews points out there's cases, state cases and lower federal cases, that allow self-defense instructions when there's accident or heat of passion. However, when you're claiming accident or heat of passion, you're necessarily admitting that you used physical force. You're just not admitting that you had the requisite mens rea for the original charged crime.
Excuse me, counsel, I understand your point, but I wonder if it makes sense in the context of an identification case. Just to give a hypothetical, suppose the defendant had a twin brother, an identical twin brother, and there was some dispute about who it was, and defendant loses, maybe the defendant's going to lose on that issue. Why shouldn't they be able to also argue self-defense under those circumstances?
Because again, there would be no reason to argue self-defense when the primary theory of the case is, and actually in this case, the only theory of defense is that it wasn't him, that it was mistaken identity. The affirmative defense presupposes that the defendant himself acted or used physical force. So even in that case.
So even when it's an identification issue, too bad. You cannot take, even though there may be a bulletproof, so to speak, self-defense, you can't claim that if you want to also claim your own innocence and not being the person.
I think if you wanted to do that, you would have to do that from the beginning. You couldn't, even though the defendant here endorsed self-defense as one of his affirmative defenses, everything leading up to the tendering of the instruction indicated that he abandoned that theory of defense. So if he had, in the beginning, said, well, this could be my brother, but if it's not, it was self-defense, then that would be a separate issue. Perhaps that would be a better case, but here there is no indication that he was going to claim self-defense. His only theory of defense was that he was not the shooter. And you can look at his theory of defense that he tendered before the judge, the trial court, rejected his affirmative defense instruction, and he asserted. The defendant asserts that he did not shoot the victim on March 27, 2011 at Soto's nightclub. The defendant asserts that he was mistakenly identified as the shooter and that he is not the person seen shooting the victim on the surveillance video. There's no indication that he's raising self-defense. Rather, he was just going to put the defense in the instructions and require the prosecution to basically argue against itself because its burden was heightened. And his burden was heightened after the close of evidence, where throughout that portion of trial, there had been no indication that he was going to claim self-defense.
So you're claiming surprise?
Partially. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it shouldn't have been allowed. It's just the fundamental fairness. When we're going to be raising the burden on the prosecution, they should know that the burden is going to be raised so that they can present evidence to meet that burden. Whereas a lesser included offense or lesser non-included offense, those offenses are lesser. They're within the burden they already have. So if they prove their case, then they necessarily prove that lesser included offense or, lesser non-included is an alternative that the jury could certainly convict him on also, but not completely absolve the defendant of culpability.
So, Mr. Olivares, do you agree that the victim told the police that he saw the gun and he struck the defendant in the face anyway?
I believe, and I, I can't remember specifically that part from the record, but I believe he said he saw a flash of something, and then you know, felt the punch on his face. He thought it was a punch, and afterwards he said it was a pistol whip. So that goes to, I'm sorry, just to finalize the affirmative defense and lesser offenses, and then we can talk about the facts. The fact that a defendant has to admit that he was using force is consistent with Whatley. I believe that case was from 2000, where the defendant was claimed that he did not use physical force against the police officers, and then the trial court said that self-defense was not available to him. And then in Brown, the Colorado Supreme Court acknowledged that there was a difference with affirmative defense, that affirmative defenses are a different case when it talked about voluntary intoxication, because it said voluntary intoxication is only a partial defense, not a full defense, and went on to say that voluntary intoxication is allowed when it's inconsistent with other defenses. So regarding the facts, Judge Roman, you were talking about.
Yeah, tell me the chronology as you understand it, having read the record.
Sure. From what I remember from the record, the defendant, or the victim, was talking to his friends in this crowded group on the smoking area of this bar, and did a handshake with another person that he recognized, and then the defendant was walking by and saw this handshake and began engaging the victim in conversation. And the victim initially was brushing the defendant off, and the defendant was persistent, and then it began to escalate. The victim admitted to saying, I'll fight you, when the defendant continued to pester him. And then when they approached, when they got together, the defendant punched him or pistol whipped him in the face, and then the victim punched him back, and you can see that in the video, at which time the defendant raised his gun, which he had already had in his hand. The victim turned away and ran along with the rest of the crowd, and the defendant shot him twice in the back. And then the defendant proceeded to run away at that point. So in light of those facts, no reasonable jury would find that the defendant was acting in self-defense. It's pretty clear from the facts that the defendant punched first, but the defendant was the original person who engaged the victim in conversation. And it should also be pointed out that the charges for assault and attempted murder weren't for the punch, it was for shooting. So the self-defense had to justify the shooting and not just the original punch. And then you can look at the victim's own statements when he talks to the police, which were admitted at trial. When he was talking to police, the victim didn't claim that he was acting in self-defense. He didn't claim that he subjectively believed harm was imminent. He didn't claim that he reasonably believed shooting the defendant or the victim was necessary. He said, "I didn't even know the kid. I didn't even know him. You know what I mean? It's just the way his persona is. Y'all got the tape. Y'all see. You would have heard how he treated me." Those statements don't indicate that he was defending himself. Those statements indicate that he was defending his reputation, which don't justify shooting the victim twice in the back while he was running away. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the decision below. Thank you.
I wanted to start out by addressing your question, Judge Roman, about where in the record the officer testified about him seeing the gun first. It's the 11-16-11 transcript, pages 31 to 32 and 42 to 43. In terms of addressing the state's arguments, I had about 3 points I wanted to make. The state talks about Brown saying Matthews isn't binding. Just to be clear, the state is referring to the lower decision, the Court of Appeals decision in Brown. And the Colorado Supreme Court later cited Matthews with approval without addressing that issue or saying that Matthews wasn't binding. Also, the state made a point that there has to be some admission of force, but in Brown, there was no admission of force. The defendant actually testified that he wasn't even at the scene of the crime. He was passed out drunk somewhere else, and the court still held that he was entitled to the instructions. And then the cases that the state cites, the Court of Appeals cases dealing with entrapment, I would argue that a couple of those cases are distinguishable because the defendant testified, and so they're more akin to the Garcia case, where the defense was inconsistent with the defendant's sworn testimony. Here, that's not a concern because Mr. Dillon never testified. I would also argue that those cases are wrongly decided to the extent that they hold that the defendant has to make some verbal admission or admit guilt, or I'm sorry, admit commission of the crime in order to get an affirmative defense instruction. The Colorado Supreme Court cases that discuss the fact that an affirmative defense is an admission are really only talking about distinguishing between an affirmative defense and a traverse and understanding how those two different kinds of defenses work. They are not addressing the issue that we're talking about here, which was the issue that was addressed in Brown.
Excuse me, counsel. Do you agree with Mr. Olivares that nothing was said about self-defense until after the evidence had closed?
No, actually, I disagree with that. The defense was endorsed prior to trial in the defense endorsement of defenses. And also, just the argument that the prosecution was surprised here, I think is untenable. The evidence itself raised the issue. The prosecution introduced a statement, which arguably, they argued, it was the defendant admitting that he was there and shot the victim, even though, you know, we as the defense argued that that could be interpreted differently and was not not an admission. The state was the one that introduced that and argued that it was an admission. So arguably, you know, the state is trying to use an admission and then argue that, oh, he didn't make an admission, so therefore you cannot instruct on self-defense. And then finally, the defendant, the case law is clear, the defendant does not have to testify to raise the issue of self-defense. People be Coughlin, the defendant properly got self-defense instructions without testifying. In People v. Pinson, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1974, it says the defendant is not required to admit guilt to obtain an entrapment instruction. That case has never been overruled. And then, of course, there's all the case law, including Pickering, which talks about a self-defense instruction being required even if the evidence, the state's evidence, is the only evidence raising the issue. So I think the case law, in general, if you look at it, is clear that there's no requirement that the defendant admit guilt in order to obtain an affirmative defense instruction. In conclusion, I would just argue that this error does require reversal under the case Garcia, Colorado Supreme Court case, when the court lowers the state's burden by erroneously disallowing affirmative defense, the error cannot be deemed harmless. And even assuming that some kind of harmless error standard applies, as the state argues it does, here it would not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the jury was not instructed on that issue. They didn't even consider the issue, and they weren't allowed to look at the facts and decide whether the shooter was acting in self-defense.
Ms. Finnis, I appreciate that you want to focus on issue four. I just want to flip to issue one really quick.
Sure.
I just want you to clarify something for me. The trial court appears to base its decision on right to silence. In your arguments, it appears to be based on right to counsel, although the supplemental authority is right to silence. So I just want to clarify what rights being asserted.
Well, arguably, Mr. Dowling was asserting both rights. He had just been informed of his rights to silence and to counsel. They asked if he understood those rights. He confirmed that he did. And then they said, well, having those rights in mind, do you wish to speak to us now? And he said, I don't know. So arguably, he was invoking both rights, or ambiguously. I think it's ambiguous. That's why I didn't argue it was an unambiguous invocation, because I don't think it's clear, but I do think that it's enough that a reasonable officer in the situation should have understood that he might be invoking his rights to silence and to counsel.
Thank you.
So if he doesn't mention counsel or attorney, and the question before him didn't involve counsel or attorney, do we still assume that he's invoking the right to counsel?
Well, I talked about in the opening brief how it's a totality of the circumstances test when you're trying to determine if that's an invocation or not. And one of the factors that you look at is the conversation, what's been previously said. And I believe I cited a case where they had just invoked, told him about his right. And they looked at that as a factor in determining whether it was an ambiguous invocation. And here it's the same situation. They had just apprised him of his right and then asked him, do you want to speak to us? And he said, I don't know. So I think you have to sort of take into account the totality of the conversation and the circumstances there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. They were very helpful. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.